This is Pro Blogger.
Hi there, my name's Darren Rouse and welcome to episode 128 of the Pro Blogger podcast, where today I'm celebrating the first year anniversary of the start of this podcast. It was exactly 1 year ago, 30th of June 2015, that I kicked things off. And I thought about doing a show today on what I've learnt since then. I did a similar show back in episode 50, but instead of doing that, I thought what I would do is pick the brains of another podcaster who used to be a blogger, Brooke McCallery from slowyourhome.com, and also the founder of the Jack Rabbit Podcast Network. She's an Aussie blogger, lives in Sydney, mum, wife, a blogger. Well, she used to be a blogger, and that's what we're going to talk about in today's episode. Brooke has brought a wealth of information to today's chat. I interview her over the next hour, so you want to grab a cuppa of your favorite beverage. And we're going to talk about her journey from going from a blogger to a podcaster. She's going to give you some practical tips on how to get a podcast up and running, particularly from the perspective of a blogger. We're going to talk about the technical stuff you need to know, how to decide what content format to go with. And we're going to talk about how to push past some of the obstacles that are in your head, some of the fear associated with podcasting, some of those comparisons that we feel as podcasters and bloggers as well, how to launch your podcast, how to monetize your podcast, and why she started a podcast network. And then there's a whole heap of other stuff, including a couple of attempts at humor at me, which I'm not sure how they went, but as I mentioned during the show, I'm getting tired. It's getting towards the end of a busy time for me and we're about to go on holidays. So please forgive me for my attempts at humor during the show today. I hope you really do enjoy this. I had a ball interviewing Brooke and I encourage you to check out what she's doing over at slowyourhome.com and the Jack Rabbit Podcast Network, jackrabbit.fm. You can also find today's show notes over at problogger.com/podcast/128. Thanks for listening, and I'll wrap things up at the end of the chat.
Creating great content, finding an audience, building engagement, monetizing your blog. This is Pro Blogger.
So, Brooke, how do you introduce yourself to new people? How do you describe yourself?
That's a good question. I do now describe myself as someone who runs a podcast network. I think that's probably the thing that I usually lead with, and then people will go, either what's a podcast or how do you do that and why is that a job? And you know, I'll often then talk about my podcast and I guess how it sort of, you know, grew, and I became more and more passionate about the medium of podcasting and decided to launch a network. So, that's a way that I will introduce myself.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, how would you have introduced yourself?
I would have said a writer 2 years ago.
Okay. So there's been a bit of a transition there, which is interesting. Mm. I love your story in that you kind of started blogging, or you started your online presence out of your own personal kind of journey, I guess, and time you were going through. I wonder if you can give listeners just a quick insight into how you started blogging, and we'll certainly be digging into podcasting, but where did it all begin for you?
It was about 6 years ago, and I was struggling significantly in my personal life. Like, everything was good, but everything was also not good at all. I was diagnosed with postnatal depression after our second child was born. And as part of that process and the treatment, it was very strongly recommended to me that I start to chill out a little bit and simplify my life somewhat. And that was not an easy suggestion for me to hear. Hmm. But I, slowly started to, you know, recognize that something had to give. And I was literally Googling, how do I simplify my life? And the ultimate irony is that that's how so many people have found me in the years after. But I found Leo Babauta's blog, Zen Habits, and I realized that there was this whole group of people around the world who felt similarly and had decided that actually they're going to live with less. And it was, yes, less stuff, but also less stress and less expectations and less commitment and less overwhelm and less debt and anxiety and, you know, all these things. And I realized when I was reading this blog that I wanted to be one of those people. And for the first time, the idea of simplifying and slowing down actually appealed a lot to me. And from there, I started to make changes to our home and my life. And, you know, I started to write about it. I had dabbled in blogging before, but never anything with a real strong purpose. And I launched Slow Your Home in September of that year, I think. And, started writing about my own process of decluttering specifically. And people started paying attention, and I slowly shifted into the idea of slow living rather than necessarily simple, you know, simplifying and decluttering over the coming years. And that's really where I found my groove.
Mm. So did you start with an audience in mind, or was it more self-expression? Or a bit of both?
Yeah, it was a bit of both, actually. I mean, I'd be lying if I said I didn't hope for it to grow and the audience to grow and people to start finding value in what I was writing. But it also helped me a lot to, I guess I don't really know what I'm thinking until I've written it. Mm. If that makes sense. That's really how I kind of process information and transformation. So part of it was absolutely me just working stuff out. And the other part was certainly to try and help people and eventually help more people.
Yeah. And did the content on the blog start what I'm discovering, that type of content, or was it how-to type content, or and has it changed?
Definitely what I'm discovering kind of content. Mm. It was a lot more introspective, and that I think is what initially drew people to my writing. But over time, people then started asking me how to do things, because it looked like from the outside that I had this stuff sorted out. And people were asking, well, how do I do this and how do I do that? Not so much, why do you do that? And it did definitely shift over the subsequent years to be more about how I could help other people work through this, you know, this stage that they might have found themselves in. I think I actually shifted back towards more of a personal style of blogging before I shifted to the podcasting. And I think that was probably symptomatic of the fact that I was a bit burnt out on the how-to stuff.
Hmm.
Which then led me into podcasting, which we can talk about later, but it definitely changed over the years.
Yeah, it's interesting. We get a lot of questions from people about, you know, do I need to be an expert in a field before I can start blogging? And I always talk about my own experience of pro blogger starting out telling my story of what I was discovering. And it sounds like you had a similar experience and then became perceived as the expert as a result of sharing what you were learning.
Exactly. You know, and I certainly wasn't and still would not ever put myself out there as someone who knows a whole heap about, you know, simple living and slow living other than what I personally experienced. So it was always kind of, there was always a tension there for me in producing that how-to sort of content. You know, I tried for it to be as authentic and helpful as possible, but I also did feel like, you know, why would you listen to me? Because I'm only just working this stuff out too.
Yeah, it sounds like a bit of imposter syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
You got it. We just had an episode go live in the last couple of weeks on that exact topic. Do you have any words of wisdom for anyone who's struggling with imposter syndrome, or are you the wrong person to ask?
I am so the wrong person to ask. I was actually, I've got that episode lined up to listen to next, but I read through the blog post just yesterday. I'm like, yeah, no, that's actually me. So look, I mean, I think I've made strides against that over the past few years. Otherwise, I probably would have given up by now. But I certainly do, you know, find myself full of self-doubt most days. But I find a certain amount of faking it till you make it helps. You know, not in a way that makes you inauthentic, but a way that kind of says, all right, you can do this. And you take that, like that wobbly courage that you talk about, and just grab onto that and don't worry about the, you know, the inner mean girl who comes along later and tells you that you're full of it.
Well, everyone needs to go and listen to episode 121 about the sounds of things. It's one I actually listened to again yesterday, because I as much as I just published that, I had a day yesterday where I suffered with it and had to go and rev myself up by listening to my own podcast. So it's one we have to keep coming back to. I think it'll be listened to a fair bit, that one. So you started with the blog. Did you have a tipping point with the blog, or was it a slow growth?
No, it was pretty slow. A slow growth, I mean, pretty steady over the years. I think once I started connecting with other people in my you know, my area, like Joshua Becker and the guys from The Minimalists and Courtney Carver and things like that. And we started to really, like share each other's work, and we found a commonality. Then people started to become more aware of the blog, and then my name started getting mixed in with those names of those people. And I think that if there was a tipping point, that probably would have been it. And that was really just a case of relationships and persistence and time and practice.
You're listening to Pro Blogger.
So things evolved from just a blog. How did you start the podcast? Why did you start it? Was there a moment of insight that really propelled you into that, or was that a bit of a slow burn too?
No, actually, it was the opposite. It was really almost an impulsive thing to try. I had been interviewed for quite a few podcasts over the past 6 months before we launched and really enjoyed it. I didn't expect to enjoy it because, I don't love the sound of my own voice or anything like that, and I'm constantly hoping that what I'm saying is useful. But I've really enjoyed the process of getting to know someone and then people getting to know me by listening to me rather than reading my words. And I'm a big podcast fan myself. I listen to a lot of podcasts and have done for years, and really love the connection I feel with the people whose shows I listen to. I mean, I don't know them, but I really feel like I do know them, and at least in some way. And I said to my husband, I'm thinking of starting a podcast. He's like, cool. And that was it. You know, I recorded 5 episodes and they were like, not great, but I pushed them all out in the first week, and you know, people seemed really excited about the prospect, and I kind of just kept going, and it grew from there. But it was definitely not something that I, you know, kind of weighed up a lot over time. It was just a let's try and see.
So that was April 2015.
Yep.
So you're 15 months in now. Give us a before and after, a glimpse of, you know, what impact the podcast has had in terms of, you know, reach maybe, and also the impact, I guess, that it's had on your audience. Has it been different to the blog?
Oh, yeah. It's been enormous, actually. In numbers, sure, but more in the way people connect with me. You know, I've found that engagement on Facebook particularly has taken off, and Instagram as well, because people really feel like we're friends. You know, we know each other, and that's... it's something that was very rarely there with the writing. I mean, people would write to me privately and say, it's like you're in my head, when I was blogging more regularly. But with the podcast, it was something different. It was a real life sort of connection that people had. And I mean, the numbers on the blog, because I obviously still publish 2 blog posts a week when I publish episodes of the podcast, the numbers have dropped a little bit on the blog, and comments and things like that have dropped right off, which is to be expected because they're different forms of communication. Mm-hmm. But the show has just about to be downloaded for the millionth time, and that is more, significantly more than the readers that I would have had a year ago on the blog rather. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's changed my relationship with the people who read and listen to what I have to say.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. That's awesome. Are you going to have a party?
Oh, yeah, I think I will. Buy a bottle of bubbly and, yeah, pop it on air maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, you definitely should. Definitely should. Okay, so I know as people are listening, they're wanting to ask you questions. So I've pulled together some of the most frequently asked questions that I get around the practicalities of getting a podcast up and running, because I think a lot of our listeners are, you know, overwhelmed by the technology and some of these sorts of questions. And I know it's the wrong place to start talking about technology. Everyone always wants to know what microphone we use. So maybe if we can start off with some of the technology type stuff, what do you recommend if someone's just starting out that they need in terms of the physical stuff, but also perhaps some of the software and things like that that you would use or recommend?
Yeah, sure. I straight out of the gate, I still use an Audio-Technica 2100, just the ATR 2100 with a pop filter. And it's just a run-of-the-mill USB mic that I bought on Amazon. I think it was about $70. And it's been fine. We will probably upgrade at some point this year because, you know, we know that this is a long-term thing that we're doing now, and we can afford to put a bit more money into our sound and our equipment. But really, you just need – some form of microphone to capture your voice to begin with. It's just, I know people who have started podcasts who are just using inbuilt mic on their laptop. Mm. And I think it's more about how you use the equipment that you have rather than the equipment itself. So I would always say, as important as your microphone or your recording equipment is, the room that you sit in and the sound that you get from the room that you sit in. So nothing too echoey, or, you know, not too many hard surfaces that the sound bounces around off. As long as you have a way to record that and it's listenable, then, you know, it's fine. But there's a handful of really decent USB microphones that you can pick up for between $40, $50, and $100 if that's something that you really do want to start with. And you're probably going to be quite happy using that for years. In terms of software, because I record most of my interviews via Skype, so I just use Ecamm call recorder to record both sides of the conversation. If it's just a solo show, or my husband and I are doing like a hosts only show, we record in GarageBand. We've got two mics, obviously, and we just record straight into GarageBand. I do all of the production on Audition now, and Ben used to do all the production on Audacity, but we've just changed to Audition recently. You know, you need a host of some description. You can host your podcast on your own website, but I wouldn't recommend that because, you know, bandwidth and things like that will very soon get sucked up. But yeah. I've just changed over to Omni for hosting. I was with Libsyn, and there's Blueberry. There's a handful of quite inexpensive media hosts. So I think once you've got, you know, a way to record and capture that audio, a way to edit, even just very light editing, you know, top and tail with some music, and then a way to publish it, they're really the three main things that you need.
Sure. Did you have any help setting it up, or any resources that you found helpful to, you know, walk you through the setting up of, you know, feeds and getting into iTunes and that type of thing?
I did. I've been a member of Fizzle.co for a few years, and they had a podcasting basics course, which took you through like the basics, you know, the real essentials of getting the show recorded, basic editing, and then publishing to iTunes and various other platforms. And that was really helpful. I mean, I think the thing that I discovered was I thought that was it. You know, once I knew that and it was it. I think the more you learn, the more you realize there is to learn. So, you know, it's kind of important to not get too deep into the really nitty gritty of the technical stuff. Otherwise, you can just get buried and it'll be months before you emerge with the show.
Yeah. I've seen people get so bogged down in which microphone to buy that it takes them 3 months just to make that decision. So just, yeah, you can start light. And if you go back to the start of almost every podcast, you see that it evolves over time so much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The more you know, the more you need to know. So, yeah, there's plenty of time to learn. What do you think aspiring podcasters should be asking about? You know, they always ask about the microphone. What should they be really asking about? What's more important, I guess, in your mind that you should be, you know, thinking about before you launch or before you even start recording?
Yeah, I think really the most important thing to ask is, like, why are you doing this? What do you want to create with the podcast? And that really takes into consideration your audience. So whether or not you want to simply entertain people or educate or inspire them or a combination of all three, and then think about your message and what you want to share and how that is going to do those things for your audience, you know. It's also helpful, I think, to ask yourself what you want to get out of the project. If you want to, you know, increase your readership of your blog or sell more of your product or become known as an authority in your niche or your area of expertise, you know, and I think depending on what your answers are to those questions, that's really going to shape the way your podcast comes together. Because I think, I mean, there is like literally thousands of combinations of show formats and elements that you can pull in. And the way your show looks is certainly partly what you enjoy and what you want your show to look like, but it's also about the people who are going to be listening to it and what's going to serve them well and what they're going to get the most out of it. So I think, you know, the content obviously is more important than the technology, but it's quite easy to kind of toss up you know, decisions on microphones or, you know, editing software. And it's I don't know, it's a question that people come to later or even on the fly as they're starting to record. So I think it's definitely key to sit down and think about that stuff before you start recording.
Okay, so your first question there was, you know, what are you aiming to do for your audience, entertain, educate, inspire? What did you decide for your first podcast? Because now you've got six in the network, two of which, is it two that you're fairly heavily involved with
yes.
on air? Yes. So let's go back to the Slow Your Home podcast. What did you decide? Was it education, inspiration?
It was mostly the latter two, so educate and inspire initially. And it's interesting to see how it's changed over the past 15 months. But I didn't think that I necessarily had the chops to educate people myself. So I decided pretty much straight from the get-go that I would be interviewing people who had insights into like a certain area of slow living or, you know, something that was related to slow living, something that I knew that my audience wanted to know more about, and I didn't have the ability to talk to them about it with any kind of authority. So that was one of the big reasons why I decided on the interview format. And then the entertainment stuff kind of came in a little later, but I realized that when people like you, you know, when people feel warm about you as a person, like they don't have to think that you're awesome or funny or anything like that or particularly clever, but they like your company, then I think they're going to stick around even more and listen to episodes that maybe they wouldn't have necessarily thought would have been something they're interested in, which is something that people tell me a lot now. So the entertainment stuff sort of came into it a little later. And it's not about cracking jokes or anything like that, but really just becoming more personable and not just about delivering information you know, to the audience.
I love that. You started with, okay, I want to educate. And then the question came, the format, you know, you felt you weren't able to educate, although I suspect you've got a lot of information you could deliver. So you went the interview. For me, I decided I wanted to educate as well, but had a whole heap of information that I knew was ready to go. So I decided on more of a talking head type podcast. So we've both kind of gone the same direction, but decided based on our circumstances to format it in a different way.
And I think part of that is also the topic as well. I mean, because with the work that you do, there are areas of, you know, of blogging and monetizing and working online that you can kind of deliver in almost tutorial style fashion. And I worry about with slow living because it's not as black and white and it's really, it applies to people's circumstances in completely different sorts of ways. I don't like the idea of saying there's only one way to do it.
So you're unpacking it with another person.
Yeah.
You know, helps people to, I guess, see different perspectives. And yeah, exactly. I love that. So the second question you said to ask was, what do you hope to get out of the project? What did you want to get out of Slow Your Home when you started it?
I initially wanted to get out of writing blog posts. I thought that it would be less time intensive than writing my twice weekly blog posts.
Yep.
So that is a completely honest answer. But I also did want to connect with people and I wanted to try something new. And also I had noticed that there weren't many podcasts in my sort of area of self-improvement, I guess, in Australia. And I thought that that did show that there was a, you know, a real potential there to cut through and maybe get in touch with new people in a different kind of way. So, you know, I I'd be lying if I said I wasn't hoping to build a profile as well, I think. And all of those things have kind of played into it over time.
Creating great content and building your audience. This is ProBlogger.
Let's shift to content. We've already kind of touched on, you know, format, you know, so you've got interviews, you could do a co-hosted show, you could do a talking head type show, and there's probably others as well. How would you advise people to make that decision? We've kind of touched on some of it, but do you have anything else that you'd add to that?
I think it also helps to know what you'd be comfortable with. Mm. I think some people are quite comfortable just sitting in front of their computer and delivering a talking head style show. They might map out what they want to say and just work through those points and be really comfortable with that, whereas other people feel more energized maybe. And energy is a really important part of a podcast, I think. So some people feel more energized if they're sitting with a co-host or that they take turns presenting with a co-host, or, you know, you can really mash them up together and try new things and see what works. But I think it is important to kind of question where your strengths lie and also understand where your strengths don't lie, and try and create a format that works to support both of those areas.
Mm. Yeah, I think probably looking around at what other people are doing is one to consider as well, in that if everyone's doing interviews on your particular topic, there's probably an opportunity there to take a slightly different approach.
Absolutely. And also what you enjoy listening to.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a big part, because you're going to be doing this long term, and, you know, if it energizes you to be doing interviews, wonderful. But if it doesn't, you know, if you find that really quite exhausting, then maybe mix it up or try something else.
Mm. So in your network at the moment, you've got 6 podcasts going, two of which are single host shows and 4 of which I think are co-hosted. Do you have any reflections from a getting them together type, you know, the production level? What's easier and what's done better in terms of, have you noticed any results yet?
I think that, I mean, some of the shows are only quite new. We're only sort of 10 or 11 episodes in, so it's hard to pull anything particularly concrete out of it. But people do tend to warm to the conversational, like co-hosted style shows, because I think they enjoy the idea that they're sitting in on a conversation between friends.
Mm.
That's something that, like, Carly and Stacey are getting really good feedback on. It's like literally listening to a conversation about Sweet Valley High with friends and having a glass of wine. And, you know, it's a real social sort of feel. And then you've got, you know, Nick Avery's show, This Family Life, or the Thoughtful Travel podcast with Amanda, where they are delivering pockets of conversation about a particular topic, which is in an interview style, but then it's broken up with solo hosted, you know, parts of the show as well. And I think just in a practical sense, there's more editing and post-production involved in those sorts of shows too, but they're perfectly suited to the topic that they cover, because it really is informational and very kind of inspiring and educational. And it delivers them really sharply, those bits of information. Whereas the conversational shows might have a broader base of topics, and the subjects can be, you know, really quite wide ranging.
Mm.
And I think that lends itself to more a conversational co-hosted style show. So again, I think it's, you know, it depends on what you're trying to share with people, and the style of like the message and the style of the, you know, the topic that you're covering, as well as the people involved and what they would prefer.
Yeah. I love in your network, you've got the co-hosted shows, quite different personalities as well, and they kind of, I know you and Kelly in yours come from slightly different perspectives, probably similar values and goals and that type of thing, but very different personalities, and I think that comes over really well. So probably one thing to factor into choosing a co-host if you go that direction.
There's been a number of times that we've been kind of told that it would be interesting if people would disagree. So I think that's happened with Ben and I on our show too.
Mm.
And people quite enjoyed the accidental release of an unedited show where we did have an argument. So, you know, but I think people get a better sense of you as a person and your relationship when they hear you kind of have coming at it from a different point of view. So yeah, it's always fun to put two kind of different styles of personalities together.
Yeah, I think you're completely wrong there. No. Okay, so let's talk about, I don't know. I'm ready for a holiday. Things are falling apart here. The beginnings. Let's talk about getting going. And I think a lot of the obstacles that I struggle with when I started my podcast were internalized obstacles, like they were just the way I was thinking, my own fear and insecurities. Do you have any tips on, you know, that beginning process, getting past those obstacles that come your way?
Yeah, those comparisons are really tough to kind of let go of. And I felt the same thing. And I think the only way that I got through it was to record those first 5 episodes and hand them to my husband and get him to edit them.
Yeah.
And so I didn't go back, and I wasn't, you know, at pains to listen to the number of times I said or stumbled over my words or sounded like I was getting breathless, you know. So I just think at some point you need to commit to it, record them, don't kind of go back over them with a fine-tooth comb and look at all the things you could have done better. Because I think when you're doing that, you're comparing yourself to maybe Amy Porterfield or Will Anderson or the guys who put together Serial and, you know, things like that. And you're saying, why aren't I better? And the reality is that, like, those guys are professionals and they've been pulling together audio programming for a long, long time. And that was, like, that was very much my headspace. I was comparing myself to these professionals. The way I got past it was to, like, simply run straight past it and get those first few episodes out as quickly as possible with, and you know what? I still haven't listened to them. I will not listen to my own voice.
It is a tough one. How do you get comfortable with finding your voice and, you know, finding your style in terms of talking on your podcast?
Yeah, I think there's two elements to that. Like, part of it is just getting used to how you sound, which I have not been able to do. So I just don't listen to it and, you know, try not to think too much about it once it's been said. And the other part is those first episodes, those first months, for me, it was sort of the first 12 months really where I felt I was still trying to find my feet and find my actual voice and my energy and my presentation style and the way that I question people and to stop comparing it to the way other people do it. So I think it's like I don't think that there is a shortcut, to be honest. I think it's just committing to this project mid to long term and understanding that it will get better over time. And, you know, and being okay with that. Like I listen to the Nerdist podcast. It's one of my favorites. And they've been publishing for 5, 6 years, maybe 7 years. And someone asked Chris Hardwick recently, how long did it take until you felt like you were, you know, you were yourself and you were doing a good job on air? And he said at least 2 years.
Yeah.
And I initially found that really disheartening. But it's actually quite liberating when you think about it because you just allow yourself to basically practice in public and, you know, it takes time to find your feet. And I think it was nice to realize that someone who I view as like a professional who's a very skilled interviewer took that long to find their feet and, you know, start producing a podcast that he was really happy with. I figure then, you know, it's okay for me.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell always talks about 10,000 hours before you are at a level where you're capable of doing something almost or an expert in something. And I think with blogging, it's certainly probably the first 1,000 posts you write, really, until you find your voice and probably the first 100 or 200 episodes and of your podcast before you begin to, I guess, feel comfortable with yourself and you get over some of those insecurities, although I don't think they always ever really go away.
I don't think they ever do either.
What about creating content? You hinted there, your first 5 episodes you batched. Is that something you continue to batch create your work?
I do when I can. We do that for the other shows on the network. Typically, we'll get together and maybe record 2 or 3 episodes at a time. And when we publish weekly, it's really nice to kind of have 2 to 4 weeks in the can ahead of time.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm responsible for doing almost all the post-production on all the shows. So for me, that's kind of a necessity just so that I don't lose my mind every Friday, making sure that everything's ready for the following Monday and the following week's releases. So that definitely just allows for, you know, people to get sick and it allows for technical issues and it allows for people's internet to get cut off and it doesn't ruin the consistency of publishing, which I think is really important. With the Slow Home podcast specifically, this year we've started doing something new, which is a monthly experiment. And every Monday, my husband and I will sit down and talk for 10 or 15 minutes about the experiment that we're currently doing and how we're finding it. So that is pretty much recorded in real time. And that is definitely more stressful.
Yep.
So I would always recommend, unless you're doing something that's super interactive and essentially recording a live podcast, then I would definitely recommend batching for the first, you know, 6 months and until you find your groove.
Yeah, and I think it really does help in those early times to get into the flow of editing, particularly if you're doing all your own editing.
Yeah.
You need to build a system or a workflow almost around it. Is that what you've got?
I do, yeah. I've got it quite tightly locked down now, actually. And since bringing on the other shows into the network, it's been very helpful for me because, I mean, I'm communicating with the host and the creators of the shows, and I've pulled together a workflow document that goes to everyone now. So Everyone knows what needs to happen, when, and, you know, how much lead time we need, and what documentation I need in terms of show notes and things like that ahead of time. And it's been so helpful now to be able to plot exactly where I'm at with every show for every week. And, you know, to be able to get 3 or 4 weeks out is, I think that's just my dream.
How to build and monetize your blog. This is Pro Blogger.
So one of the things that you touched on earlier was your energy level. You know, energy levels are so important when it comes to podcasting. And I listened to your first episode, re-listened to it again recently, and I've noticed that you've changed a lot from those first ones. It seemed to have a little bit more energy. Do you have any tips on how to bring a bit more energy to your shows?
Yeah, the first ones I'm quite sure are horrifying, actually.
They're not. They're actually, I really enjoyed them because it slow you home. Yeah. So I think if anyone can get away with a slower, lower key podcast, it's you.
That's true.
And it's your personality as well. But something's changed and I'm not really sure what it is.
I think it's just confidence. Those first few episodes, I did pretty much read them. At least the solo shows, of course, the interview ones I didn't. But the first solo shows I pretty much scripted out. And in a way, that was fine because I don't think I necessarily sounded like I was reading.
No.
And there was certain bits of information that I really wanted to walk people through. And it was kind of going back to that tutorial style show that you and I were talking about it a minute ago, because I wanted to give people valuable information. And that was the only way that I could trust that I could get through all the steps and all the, you know, all the parts that I wanted to cover. But I think that my energy, like, that did reflect in my energy levels. And now I'm pretty much wing everything. I will usually have a list of kind of general questions or talking points that I want to cover with a guest, or even with Ben and I, if we do a hostful episode. And I think that does just lend itself to more energy and a more natural way of talking. It does also help if I sit up straight. Some people enjoy standing when they record. I've tried it and it doesn't really work for me personally. But anything that kind of gives you a bit of a lift, a bit of a boost. The other thing that I found, it's just come with practice, and I'm still not great at it, but it's certainly better, was those first episodes I would record myself speaking for maybe 2 minutes and I'd be out of breath. So I'd have to stop and I'd have to catch my breath, and that doesn't happen nearly as much anymore. And I think, you know, my husband does media training, and he was watching me record one day. It's like you're talking out of the top of your chest. You know, you're not breathing into your, like, into your diaphragm at all, and that's why you're losing your breath. And having taken that on board has also helped me a lot, and I'm a lot less breathy now.
I think breathing's really important. And I've never really had any training in it, but I think as someone who's done public speaking, it's something you learn to do. So, yeah, I've never thought about that one. What about ums and ahs and that type of thing?
Yeah.
Do you struggle with that? Because I find when I'm presenting solo, I don't, for some reason, but when I interview people, I um and ah a lot more.
Yeah, and I think that's partly just conversation as well. You know, I think if you listen to a conversation with someone, there's probably more stops and starts and ums and ahs than you actually think that there would be. And it's not until you sit down and actually edit a conversation like that you recognize just how often they happen. That being said, though, I have had to, like, lock them down big time. You know, the first probably 20 or 30 episodes, my husband obviously does the recording, and he mentioned very kindly and gently that maybe I'd need to just start pausing a little bit if I feel an um or an ah coming on. And that has definitely helped. And that's something that I see pretty much every new podcaster have to work their way through. You know, people will listen back to their show and just be kind of horrified at the number of times they say or, you know, people have other verbal tics. Like, they'll start every conversation with, you know, or well, or like, you know, like I just did then. And I think it just takes time to recognize that coming on and to be able to sort of come up with strategies to stop them from taking over your conversation.
I practice it with my kids, actually. It's a something, a little game we play when they're having their bath, and we give each other a minute, and we have to speak for a minute without saying amarah, and we give each other a topic. And it's great training for them. Like, they've improved so much with their own, and it's confidence, public speaking. I'm sure it'll help them as well. So maybe that's a little game that people could play.
That is so cool. That's a really fantastic idea. I would certainly benefit from that too, and so would my kids.
And I say to them all the time, you know, there's nothing wrong with silence as well. And silence can be a very powerful thing. If you pause and then say something, then people are much more tuned in to what you're going to say next.
It's so true. I think we're terrified of leaving silence because it sort of makes us feel awkward, or, you know, has someone forgotten to say their line, or, you know, but I think a well-placed pause, or even just a well-intentioned pause, can be really worthwhile and powerful.
I've noticed, I've noticed actually some of those more professional podcasters, they use silence from time to time, and they stop the music and they stop everything, and then they have these seconds or even 2 seconds of silence, and then they start, and they do use it really well as an editing technique as well. So, yeah, something to play with, I guess. Okay, so let's talk about launching. We haven't even got to the launching yet. This might end up being a two-parter, I think. But launching your podcast, any tips around getting that going? Because you seem to come out of nowhere, and it just seemed to be, you know, you're new and noteworthy. A lot of podcasts get there, but you got featured a little bit more than that as well. Do you have any tips on, I know that's hard to have a tip on how to get featured, but any tips on launching it with a bit of a bang?
Yeah, I think the more hype and excitement you can build in your audience, if you have one, before you launch, the better, because there's a few things you can then do when you've already got people in your corner that's going to push you up as soon as you launch into either the charts or even new and noteworthy. So something that I always recommend to people is to consider starting with an episode zero, a preview episode, and putting that out a couple of weeks before your actual launch week. And that gives people the opportunity to, first of all, see what you're all about, get excited about the fact that you've got a podcast coming out. You can include in that episode zero just a basic introduction to who you are and why you're doing the show, maybe a snippet or something like that of episode one to get people enticed, and then just ask people to subscribe. And that means that when you do launch in a couple of weeks after that, The downloads, first of all, from those subscribers will be automatic. So you'll be getting a nice bump in numbers through iTunes straight away. And it also means that people are listening from day one. And I think pair that episode zero with a strong launch week or a launch month. You know, so I launched with 5 episodes in 5 days. And after that first launch week, I went back to just 1 a week. You launched with 30 episodes in 30 days. So anything, I think, that gets people routinely listening to you and getting used to what you're producing, and also, and practically speaking, getting those downloads ticking over in the first month is going to help in getting you either on the charts or in new and noteworthy. And like the new and noteworthy algorithm, I think, it's, I don't know what it is. It's a mystery.
it's all a mystery to me.
It is. Like, that's, you know, that's Apple for you though. They keep it all behind closed doors, I guess. But, you know, it's really helpful to be able to appear in the new and noteworthy for your category or even across the whole iTunes store, because then of course you'll find yourself on the front page for up to 3 months, I think is the maximum amount of time that you can appear. And all of our shows on the network have found their way into new and noteworthy, and it absolutely makes a difference in picking up new readers and growing your audience that way.
Mm. And do you have any views on how often you should publish once you get past that launch?
Not in terms of, regularity. I think just choose a publishing schedule, and then it's really important to stick to it. Mm. I think that's the more important thing. If you can only afford time-wise to publish one awesome podcast a month, you know, the first day of every month, then make sure it's there on the first day of every month and people will get used to it. You know, if you're going to publish twice a week, then make sure you have the time and the resources and the, you know, the content to be able to publish twice a week for a year or, you know, 6 months, a year, something like that. And then you can get a feel for how people are listening to it and whether or not it's enough or too much. And then you can shifted around it. We launched in April, and we took a few weeks off over Christmas of last year, and then came back with two episodes a week. We were doing one episode a week, and now we're doing two. We wouldn't have known to do that had we kind of been playing around with our publishing schedule.
Mm. And any view on length, an ideal length of show?
Interestingly, most people will come to me and say, I want to launch a show that's about 15, 20 minutes long. And then they'll start producing shows and they organically become longer than that. I initially thought that the Slow Home podcast would be about 30 minutes. Now it runs, our Thursday shows anyway, run to anywhere up to an hour. And the data that iTunes is sharing with podcasters is that long form audio is growing at a rate of knots. Mm. You know, some of the biggest shows in the world are 2+ hours long per episode. And I think that's really interesting. But I do also think that there are some topics and some podcasts that are perfect at 10, 15 minutes, you know, and there are some that are only 5 minutes long. So that's a long way of saying there's no perfect length, I don't think. I quite enjoy long form conversations myself, and most of the podcasts I listen to run at about an hour. But that's, you know, that's just personal preference, I think.
I was talking to someone recently and they said they don't like anything shorter than 20 minutes because they have to get their iPhone out and, you know, find another podcast. And they might be on a walk, or they might be washing the dishes or doing something with their hands and can't change. So they won't even listen to them if they're short. So I guess you've got to put yourself in the seat of your listener and think about what they're doing. So one of the challenges I see a lot of podcasters having is that their listeners are often doing something while they're listening, and then calling them to do something else, like calling to them to some sort of action, is tricky. So go listen to my show notes. Well, most people can't do that because they're driving a car, or they're doing the dishes, or doing the ironing, or doing something else. Any tips on getting people to take action on your podcasts?
That's actually a really good question, and I think it's part of the reason that I don't see a huge flow over of people from listening to actually reading the show notes. And I think more than anything, what I've discovered is it's just repetition of a suggestion of an action rather than an immediate sort of action that people are going to take. So similarly with like an Audible sponsorship, like code or something like that, people probably aren't going to put down what they're doing the second they hear it. But if they find themselves thinking about getting an audiobook from Audible, they will then go, and because it's something they've listened to maybe for the last 3 months. So I think, I don't know. I mean, I do know a lot of people say that having a benefit, maybe a product or a download or something like that, that people can only get from your website does help getting people over there. But I do think that they're just two completely separate mediums. And sometimes it doesn't sort of cross over all that effectively. So just a consistent kind of reminder rather than expecting people maybe to go over and do that thing right now.
Yeah. I guess most people are listening to a podcast on the mobile as well. And so there's another factor there that whatever you call them to do, they need to be able to do it probably on their mobile phone as well.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to Pro Blogger.
Okay, so you touched on Audible there as a sponsor. How do you monetize? How do you keep what you're doing sustainable? You've got six of these in your network now. What's the model?
that's a tricky question. Look, what we're finding is that people are really like, we're still working on it. Like, to be perfectly blunt and honest, it's not something that is sustaining itself yet. I mean, I guess in a way, I find it trickier to work with brands because of like my personal philosophy, which is my personal brand of, you know, slow living and simple living. I'm not going to turn around and shill
more stuff.
Exactly. You know, so I do need to be and have always been really cautious about any kind of relationship that I have with brands. So we're finding though that, you know, as the network grows and more brands are interested in starting advertising on podcasts, the Australian brands particularly, they're just really nervous about it. You know, I think in the States, it's not by accident that you hear the same 12 brands being advertised on most podcasts. It's because the vast majority of other brands just aren't there yet. You know, so we're having to educate agencies and brands about the power of podcasting, and there's data that's just come out in the last couple of weeks where people who listen to podcasts say that they are the most, they are the least invasive form of advertising. And I think that kind of stuff is really powerful for brands who do want to start advertising on podcasts. But I honestly don't think that that's going to be a long-term thing that we're going to pursue at all, because I'm starting to see a shift towards people being really happy to financially support people who create the content that we listen to. You know, we do have a Patreon page for the Slow Home podcast, and we've got maybe 40 or 50 people who contribute to that every month, and that's really nice. It helps cover hosting and things like that. And I'm starting to see, I'm actually starting to get emails from people saying, how can we support you, which I think is a good sign. So the other thing that we're also looking at doing with most of our podcasts is bringing on a product that the host or the creator of the show has put together either specifically for the podcast audience, or that's, you know, something that they produce already, and advertise for that through their podcast. And that will be the way that most shows will be monetized, I think. And I've seen that in quite a few podcasts that I listen to, where the creators have stepped away from the traditional advertising relationship and started to create something specifically for their audience. And I'm seeing, from what I've seen anyway, that's been quite successful. So that's probably the second and the bigger area that we're starting to look into.
That's certainly something we've played around a little bit with advertising, but probably of all the shows we've done, there's less than 10% have been sponsored by anything other than ProBlogger or our event or one of our ebooks or something that we're doing at the time. I think that's probably definitely a worthwhile approach, unless you get, you know, someone who perfectly aligns with your brand. And there's probably a few of those as well that we've worked with. Yeah. So what's your approach on show notes?
I pull them together. They suck the life out of me, I have to say. It's not my favorite job. But I do think it's important for people to get a feel for what your show is about. So we will put together maybe two or three paragraphs of show notes just for iTunes and Stitcher and things like that, and that will point people towards either the Slow Home website or to Jackrabbit FM, where all the show notes live. So, you know, we'll just do a kind of basic rundown of the conversation and list any resources, any links, any books, any other podcast episodes, and allow people to discover things really easily. But I started out writing incredibly comprehensive show notes with bullet points for the entire conversation, and I found I was spending maybe 3 hours doing that, and I didn't see much return on that. I think, you know, if people, and I think I did that mostly because I had a small group of readers who were just adamantly against listening to podcasts. They said, you know, we really want you to keep blogging. So I was trying to please them and provide value to them with the show notes while also, you know, pulling together the podcast. And I just found it, you know, a really taxing task. I know a lot of, it depends. I mean, it depends on the kind of conversation, the kind of shows as well, because if I listen to a lot of comedy podcasts and things like that, and they don't need lots of show notes. But if you're doing something that is very practical or a how-to sort of episode or with loads of resources, then it could be really worthwhile for you to provide in-depth show notes. So I guess that's a long way of saying it depends on the show.
Yeah, we're moving towards more and more detail in ours, and that's just a pushback from readers, really, or listeners. And I suspect that's because we did have a sizable blog reading audience and audience of bloggers who prefer to get their information that way. So we're definitely moving almost to a transcript of our shows. Probably one of our best read show notes recently was one that Kelly Exeter did, who's one of your podcasters. She recorded the podcast for us, I Topped and Tailed It, and then she rewrote her 10 minutes of content as a blog post, and that was the show notes, and that went over very well with our readers. So it was a bit of a test for us.
Now, that's really interesting to know, actually, because the transcripts and pulling them together into a resource is something that we've been tossing about as well, because so many of our shows have, like, they're packed with little nuggets of information and tips. So, okay, that's really interesting.
And there's some reasonable transcription services out there who'll do a show for $20 if it's an hour or so. So, look, it's another expense, and it was one that I, as a bit of a tight ass, wasn't willing to go for in the early days of having a podcast that wasn't making any money. But it's certainly something that we're moving towards now with our editing sort of system. A question that I get quite a bit from new podcasters is, and they may, I know what the answer is, but I'll ask it anyway. What is a good number of downloads for an episode? What should someone be aiming for? I know that's like how long is a piece of string, but do you, perhaps a better way of asking is, do you pay attention? Do you have a threshold that in your mind is a successful show? Are you paying attention to download numbers? How do you measure success of what you're doing?
I used to pay much closer attention to download numbers, and not dissimilar to what I was like with my blog. Like I used to check my analytics religiously for years, and over the years, as other metrics like engagement started to improve, I didn't worry so much about page views and things like that. And I've kind of been similar in my approach to the podcast numbers. I mean, I will still check them, of course, to make sure that we haven't had any massive dips or any, you know, big spikes, and try to figure out why that has happened. I started out with the number 10,000 downloads an episode in my head, and I think that was mostly from resources that I'd found online about getting sponsors for the show. You know, 10,000 downloads per episode is really what a sponsor is going to be looking for before they start engaging with you. And you know, in my experience, that hasn't really been the case anyway. It's not some magic number, whereas if you're getting 9,000 an episode, by the time you get 10,000, you've got brands knocking on your door. I think it's a nice round number that people like to be able to aim for, and you're going to give a brand or a partner like a decent return. You know, they're going to get in touch with a decent sized audience. And I mean, now we're kind of hitting about 15,000 downloads in the first week, and then it obviously peters out significantly after that. But we're still getting, you know, lots of downloads on our first shows, which I guess simply shows me that people are still discovering the show and enjoying what they hear, going back and listening to it from the beginning. I feel awkward talking specific numbers because it just doesn't matter. If what you're doing is helping the people who are listening, you could be connecting with 500 people in a really helpful, authentic, valuable way every week and changing their lives or changing their business. Or you could be speaking to 100,000 people who don't care what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, and I know which one I would prefer. So I think, you know, there's a, it depends on your goal in terms of downloads and things like that. If you're looking to work with advertisers, then sure, that, you know, the higher the better as far as the advertiser is concerned. But in terms of engagement, I don't think the numbers has got a lot to do with it at all.
That's great. And I think it probably depends on your monetization as well. If you choose to monetize it, if you're monetizing with your own brand, then you probably have a more engaged audience,
and exactly,
it perhaps easier to you know, make a dollar off.
Yeah.
As well. Not that it's just about making the dollar. So do you think you're going to be podcasting for the long term? I mean, you're obviously investing more and more time into it, but you started as a blogger and you're not blogging anymore. What, is there some tension there with you? Are you comfortable with that? What's next?
There is a bit of tension there. I found myself missing writing more recently, actually. Mm. So that's probably something that I'm not willing to kiss goodbye completely. But I have fallen completely for the medium of podcasting, you know, and I can see us in this for the long haul. We're also starting to work on podcasting in a different kind of way and taking it to larger organizations and using it as an internal communications kind of method, because I think that as the spoken word is so powerful and people connect with the information that they listen to, in most instances, more than when they sit down and read information, particularly for internal communications and stuff like that in an organization. So that's something that I can see a real potential with, you know, podcasting moving forward, using it in different sorts of ways. But just the way that you can connect with people and you know, have a genuine impact on people's days and on the things that they do. And it could be an impact on their day in terms of making them laugh, but it could also be an impact on their day in terms of, you know, shifting the way they think about themselves or their home or their work or their family. And I just had never seen that to that extent when I was writing. So I'll be in it for the long haul. It's going to be absolutely fascinating though to see what the industry does and how it changes over the next few years, because I think we're just seeing it kind of being reborn in the past 18 months, 2 years, and yeah, I think it's going to change a lot.
This is Pro Blogger.
Getting towards the end here, got two more questions. The network. Why did you start a network of podcasts? And would you recommend that for other people who maybe already have a podcast? Is there some sense in having more than one?
So the network really was partly because I saw the impact that sharing a particular message or an idea could have. And I knew personally a handful of people who would benefit from that and who we'd had conversations about starting a podcast. And the vast majority of them said, I really want to, but I just don't have the bandwidth or the capacity to take on another project, or I don't have any idea about the technical side of it. And I had discovered over the past 12 months that I actually really like that side of it. I quite enjoy the editing. I quite enjoy, you know, setting up the feed and all that kind of stuff. So I saw that I could help, you know, help people start to spread their message and their word around. And I don't know, it felt right. As far as recommending it, like, absolutely, it's really satisfying, but it is a lot of work. So, you know, if you're not like scared off by the idea of all the technical stuff, then I would definitely recommend it. I think there's power in pulling similar voices together and doing something as a group. And, you know, that's what we're finding. People are starting to, like, they might discover one of our shows, and as a result of that, they then start to listen to another show and another show, and before they know it, they're listening to all six, which is, that to me is really fun. I really enjoy hearing that.
Are you cross-promoting them?
Not a lot, not actively and not specifically, but in probably a handful of shows across the network, we'll mention, you know, particularly with Kelly. Kelly and I host a show, and then she and Carly, Carly Jacobs, host a show. So they will often mention each other's shows, and then similarly with Carly and Stacey doing Sweet Teen Club. And it's sort of just more of an organic thing. I do think that that's something we'll start to we'll start to do more of over the coming months. And we're also working on a network app, which will help with, cross-show discoverability and things like that.
Yeah, I've discovered so many shows by them being featured on other shows. So it kind of makes sense, I think, to have some sort of mentioning in a formal way, I guess.
Yeah, Gimlet does that really well, actually, with their shows.
Yeah, it can almost get a little bit over, like if every guest is from the network. But I think it's certainly some benefits there. Do you think with the network it would make sense to have similar style shows or similar topics? Is that what you're going to be doing? You've got a bit of variety there, but there's perhaps some overlap between the shows?
There is overlap in most situations. It's something Ben and I actually have spoken about a lot, because we've got quite a few ideas for shows that wouldn't necessarily fit in with shows that we've currently got. So I think we're going to try and see how it goes. I mean, The common point is us, I guess, and it's things that we enjoy and things that we like, and we're not completely weird people, so I imagine there'd be other people with similar kind of similar interests. So we're going to try and sort of broaden the scope of the shows over the next 12 months. We've got another couple coming on in July, which is really exciting, and they sort of fit in with what we're currently offering. But I think by the end of the year we'll have a bit of a broader base of subjects and see. We're just going to see how it goes.
Excellent. So where can people find you? Slowyourhome.com is kind of that home. Where else should my listeners be heading right now?
Right now they can head to jackrabbit.fm is the home of the network. You can find out about our shows and a little bit more about us. And slowyourhome.com is the other place I live. And from there you can find all my social media accounts and all the other places that I hide out online.
Well, thank you very much for spending the last hour with ProBlogger. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Darren.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Brooke McCallery today. You do have a lot to chew on in that one, but if you're looking for something else to listen to now, I encourage you to go back to listen to episode 50 of this particular podcast. It's sitting there in iTunes waiting for you right now. And in that episode, I share the lessons that I learned in my first couple of months of podcasting. A lot of them are quite similar, but there's a few other new things in there that we didn't cover in this episode with Brooke. Also, you might want to check out episode 121, which we mentioned in today's podcast on imposter syndrome. It's probably the episode that I've had the most feedback on that I've recorded in the last 6 or so months. So you might want to check that one out if you missed it. I do encourage you to also check out Brooke's blog or her podcast over at slowyourhome.com and the Jack Rabbit network of podcasts. She's got 6 podcasts running in there at the moment with some great Aussie podcasters. If you like the Aussie accent, you want to check those particular ones out. Many of them are ranking really high in the iTunes store here in Australia, and for good reason. And even by the time this one comes out, there may even be a new one in there. So check out Jack Rabbit Podcast Network as well at jackrabbit.fm. Thanks for listening today. You can find the show notes where I will include a lot of the links mentioned and some of the tools that Brooke mentioned over in those show notes as well. They're at problogger.com/podcast/128. Look forward to chatting with you in the next episode, which we're going to be talking about Facebook advertising in. I've got a guest coming in to help us to navigate how to set up those first ads. It's something that a lot of bloggers do ask about, and so we've got Angela coming in to talk to us about that. Tune in a couple of days' time for that one. Thanks for listening today. We'll chat soon.
You've been listening to Pro Blogger. If you'd like to comment on any of today's topics or subscribe to the series, find us at problogger.com/podcast. Tweet us at ProBlogger. Find us at facebook.com/ProBlogger or search ProBlogger on iTunes.
Before I go, I want to give a big shout out and say thank you to Craig Hewitt and the team at Podcast Motor, who've been editing all of our podcasts for some time now. Podcast Motor have a great range of services for podcasters at all levels. They can help you to set up your podcast, but also offer a couple of excellent services to help you to edit your shows and get them up with great show notes. Check them out at podcastmotor.com.